Is technology the answer to global hunger? Will that somehow take care of it?
Well, we're in a global food crisis right now, but biotechnology is not the solution to the global food crisis. If you're a poor person throughout the world, you've seen your food cost, if you live in an urban area, go up an average of 83% in just 3 years. That is phenomenally high for people who spend most of their cash income on food.
So here we're talking about hunger induced by just the inability to pay for food, right?
Yeah. I mean, you have just this last spring about food riots in about a dozen countries. And it's not from lack of food. It's from the rapid increase in the price of food.
You're saying the food supply hasn't necessarily gotten shorter compared to people.
No. Some of it's been diverted. More of it has been diverted into things like making ethanol for fuel. And that's helped jack up the price of the crops. But it's not a shortage of corn, not a shortage of soy, not a shortage of rice. Actually, in a few places, there is a shortage of rice. But that's as much drought-related as anything.
So when it comes to the diversion, we're talking mostly about crops that are now being processed to create fuel instead of going into food. Is that correct?
That, and plus the fact that we still use a tremendous amount of basic grains for livestock feed.
So there you have plant growth that's going to meat.
Yeah.
Is the corn to ethanol a significant piece of that we're doing in the U.S.?
It is significant, but the perceived increased demand for corn for ethanol has really driven up the prices of corn. Great if you're growing corn. Bad if you're a Mexican person who depends on tortillas and suddenly finds that the price of tortillas has gone up four times.
And you say perceived diversion?
Yeah, well, there is both real diversion and long-term demand that has increased. So it may not be this year's, but the prices of futures on all of these commodities.
In the area of the engineered food,
right,
which may not be the answer to dealing with global hunger, is it part of the answer?
It might be, except that, in 30 years of making genetically modified crops, there's not a single commercial crop that's been engineered for increased yield, for drought tolerance, for salt tolerance, enhanced nutrition, or other traits that you would want if you were going to use this for fighting hunger.
Is that by choice?
Well, I think it's because of where the market's been. The seed companies are now owned by the genetic engineering companies, which are the same as the pesticide companies. So if what you're trying to sell is both seeds and pesticides, what you do is you engineer a product that lets you sell both.
And how does that work? What's that scenario?
Well, the two main things that crops have been genetically engineered to do are, one, to tolerate an herbicide. Depends on where your listeners are, but if they're mostly in the U.S., Roundup, made by the company Monsanto, is the it kills broadleaf plants very well. But if you're growing some of those broadleaf plants, you can't use Roundup unless they've been engineered to resist it. Otherwise, you'd kill both the weeds and the soybeans.
So in other words, if you engineer soybeans to be resistant to or not be affected by Roundup, you can go ahead and spread Roundup all around them to kill everything else and leave the soybeans.
Yeah.
If you've designed the soybeans to do it, is that right?
Right.
And that's the direction the genetic engineering of these plants has been going in for the past 30 years, is this kind of teamwork system?
Yeah. And, you know, the most widely cultivated biotechnology crop is Roundup Ready soybeans. Now, they actually yield 5 to 10% less than conventional varieties. Basically, sort of think about, you know, I mean, if you're making a protein that helps your plant break down Roundup, that's energy in the plant that has to go to something else, not producing food.
And what's the advantage to doing it that way?
If you are a large operation, which most third world farmers aren't, you want to reduce your labor cost. If you don't have to go back over your field to hoe, you save labor cost. You know, if you're using a mechanical hoer, you would also save fuel cost. So the advantage is, if you're a big grower, you save money.
The yield per acre is less, but you're spending a whole lot less to create it. Is that?
Yeah.
If the bioengineering actually can be successful in making changes according to what someone wants to create, is it possible to do this kind of engineering in a way that would create better yield and use fewer resources if that's what was desired?
Yeah, but you don't necessarily have to use biotechnology to do that. The biggest study ever on, you know, how we can do world agriculture was convened over the last 4 years by the United Nations and the World Bank. They concluded that biotech crops have very little potential to alleviate poverty and hunger. The big chemical and seed companies were a part of the process, and they pulled out. I think they didn't like where it was going. But what this big study by the UN and the World Bank found was that there, you know, there is another way to get better yields, to help third world farmers make more money and produce better crops. They recommended what's called agroecological farming. These agroecology techniques will actually minimize inputs, even things like fertilizers that have been coming more and more from fossil fuels. If you're a small farmer and dependent on fossil fuel fertilizer, it's going to be very expensive for you. So they're looking at intercropping corn with plants that naturally replenish the soil, naturally have chemicals to repel insects and weed pests. So you end up with fewer weeds, fewer insects, higher yields, without the farmer having to lay out lots of money for pesticides and fertilizer.
What does that mean, intercropping? Is that rows of different plants?
Yeah.
At the same time?
Yeah. It's the way farmers used to farm in a lot of places, combined with more science on how to do it better.
After all these years of studying this and looking at questions and coming up with answers, can tomatoes and corn and soybeans feed the whole world? Is that possible?
Well, you know, there's a couple of things happening at the same time. We have, for the first time in world history, a majority of people living in cities. You know, what that means is that people are much more dependent on cash income. We need to figure out how people can stay in rural areas, make enough money in the rural area so that they can still grow their own food. As more and more people are unable to grow their own food, then they're more and more dependent on these fluctuations in world food prices. Can exports of corn and tomatoes solve the problem? Well, you know, there's always going to, you know, there's always going to be some need to provide food for people that are suffering from a natural disaster, either from a hurricane or from a drought. You know, we recall in Scripture that Joseph knew that you needed to prepare for the coming flood and drought times. And he had stocks to do that. And we need, you know, as the world, to have stocks of food that can help countries when they're temporarily in trouble. What we need to avoid doing is dumping cheaply produced U.S. crops on the third world so that you put out of business the small farmers and force them to go to the city where they don't get, where they can't get a job to pay for their food.
How would one accomplish that kind of a change?
I think the kinds of techniques that what the Board of Global Ministries is calling their sustainable agriculture program and what the UN and World Bank are calling agroecological farming, those kinds of techniques are better suited to small farmers because they minimize the cash cost of farming. And, you know, I think some of what we have to do is really support eating locally, whether you're in Zambia or whether you're in Columbia, Missouri. There's real ecological and economic advantages to you purchasing as much of your food possible from local suppliers.
As a movement across with the U.S. and the world, going to local farms for your food supply is a step in dealing with global hunger then, right?
It is, you know, especially if what we're doing when we have our church projects and what we're doing when we have our international development projects is giving priority to the local farmers in Africa, the local farmers in Asia, helping them supply the local market. Then you have people able to get, they'll get fresher food, they'll get food with more vitamins, and you'll keep local farmers in business.
So where a church, as I've seen happen, is involved with local farms to bring produce in, and they'll set up outside the church, and people have subscribed to a season of food, and the cartons come, and it's all from local farms. Actually, they're doing something beyond the local then, aren't they?
They are doing something beyond the local there. And, you know, if they want to take the, you know, the next step and, you know, take up a little bit of extra money to help UMCOR with its sustainable agriculture project, that would be a way to help local farmers in Liberia. I know they've got a project there, do the same thing.
Now, in your position, are you analyzing and handing that material off to other people to then make decisions on, or do you make, are you making recommendations from what
we
you
make,
look at?
We make a lot of recommendations to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. We have a team of lawyers who sometimes sue them when they're not following the law. And we work with United Nations groups and international groups to try to help them give priority to basic food needs and priority to basic food safety.
What kind of recommendations do you make to them related to animal cloning?
We've urged them to keep their moratorium on the release of cloned animals because the research, you know, hasn't been done. The Food and Drug Administration used a incredibly small sample of cloned animals to make their decision. I mean, their largest study was on 16 cows. That's not even enough for a good dairy. So we've urged them to keep their moratorium in place. We've urged them, if they do lift it, to require labeling and tracking of all cloned animals and their offspring, because we just don't know whether the defects we're seeing in cloned animals do get passed on to their offspring and what effects they have.
Is that where that stands now? There are continuing studies?
There are continuing studies. I mean, there are some cloners that claim that they are selling offspring, and that's a problem. We worked with about 20 companies. Some of the biggest food companies have said they're not going to buy products from clones, they're not going to buy products from cloned offspring. But, you know, a lot of these new technologies come out of the box and off the shelf before they really had the kind of testing that they should have. And cloning is one of them, and, the cloning industry is following the genetically modified food industry in general by claiming they're going to solve world hunger. Well, that's not the kind of animal they've been cloning. They haven't been cloning animals that are more drought tolerant. They haven't been cloning animals that can do what third world farmers need, which is plow, give milk, and at the end of their life, give meat. Those aren't the animals they're cloning. They're cloning the big, fatty animals that are going to be used as Kobe beef or something like that.
Earlier when we talked, you mentioned the term temptation to alchemy.
Well, you know, I think your listeners will remember the story of Jesus' temptations in the wilderness. Now, I love that story because all of the temptations are to do good the wrong way. And so Jesus is tempted by the devil to turn stone into bread. And you think, wow, if you could do that, you could feed everybody in the world forever. Jesus says, you need to understand that you don't live by bread, but you live by the Word of God. And when you go to Deuteronomy and read that passage that Jesus is quoting, and you read just a little ways before you hear a discussion about why we have the poor among us, and Deuteronomy says it's because we don't forgive debt, because we don't take care of the poor. That's why we still have the poor among us. In short, we don't need to turn stone into bread. We need to care for our neighbor.
It sounds to me as if we, with the right attitude and the right approach, could do a lot of good. When we do engineering, it seems we go off into more profit-oriented directions. Some of the other things we do may be more self-preservationist.
Mm-hmm.
Are all things on the table if we have the right attitude?
Well, I think if we have the right attitude, we can use the new scientific tools to do things better than we're doing them now. We can breed plants better, that are more nutritious, by using our knowledge of genetics to improve our breeding process. We can use the science of ecology, as many of the researchers are doing now, to learn how to grow crops together in a way that they complement each other. That science that God is, helping us use and is revealing to us. But when we use the science to concentrate wealth into fewer and fewer hands, what we end up with is a lot of really poor, hungry people who don't even get to grow their own food anymore.
Is there an area in here that I need to make sure to ask you about to include?
One of the most important things, maybe, that I haven't covered enough is the need for all of us to have greater participation on the part of the people we're intending to serve. If those of us rich Americans think we have all the answers, that's only because we haven't been listening to the people in Asia and Africa and Latin America about what questions they need answered and what they think the solutions are.